Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Charity Charge Show. Today, I'm excited to feature an interview with Jason Waters, the CFO of Give Directly. Jason, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Stefan, glad to talk to you again. Thanks for having me.
Of course, of course. And you know what it's funny, I'm just going to put you on the spot. I always ask guests for their name and how to pronounce it and the title, make sure I get it all right. But I go by Steven. So now I got to change. We're all good. I just thought it was funny. So I'd mention that, but no. All jokes aside, I'm so excited to have you on this episode. I've known about Give Directly in your work, actually originally through a friend of mine, Stuart Knoll, who really, really liked your model. And I know started supporting you guys really on a sort of micro basis, you know, in the sense of the amount of money he was giving, you know, early on in his career, in his early 20s, he just like found about your model and thought it was a very like direct way to give, you know? So that's kind of how I started to learn about it. So why don't you tell us about Give Directly? I've got a lot of questions to ask you, but I also like would really appreciate if you could sort of explain your model also in the context of like what's happening in the world today, specifically with Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. Like the way you were introduced to Give Directly is really the way Give Directly started. So a little more than 10 years ago, a couple guys at MIT studying economics, asking themselves the question, how to do good in the world efficiently. MIT economists kind of want to get the most bang for their buck, started a giving group. With students and professors giving in micro ways, kind of as part of the effective altruism movement, and dedicating as a lifetime commitment a percentage of their income to doing good in the world. In their quest to figure out where to do that good, they found some research done in South America about direct cash giving, liked the efficiency and impact that they saw in that research, and two of the members of that giving circle, Paul and Michael, started Give Directly as a means to find people living in extreme poverty, UN definition below $1.90 a day, and give them cash directly. How do you get a person out of poverty? You give them enough cash to get out of poverty. And we like science, we like data, and kind of with our first big grant, a couple million dollars, went to Kenya and started one of what is now the longest running universal basic income experiment in the world. I think that's in its ninth year now, with a 12-year, and you know, saying like big payments, small payments over time, 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year, and how that affects consumption and outcomes over time. And Give Directly very slowly grew up from that until about 3 years ago. So kind of started out with $5 million, grew up to about $40 million pre-pandemic, largely building off exactly what I just described, going out to villages in Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, finding people living below the poverty line, giving them some form of cash transfer, and either like a year and a half worth of income at once as our large cash transfer, or monthly income over 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And then the pandemic hit, and kind of grown nicely up to $40 million. All the other programmatic money really fell apart. You couldn't go, you know, bring people in for classes, do technical farming assistance. The only thing you could really do is cash if you could do it remotely. Couldn't safely go door to door in these villages. And the entire world went into lockdown. There were a lot of US government response was a little slow. If you recall, some big donors came to us and said, can we do something for people living in poverty in the United States, which is not something we've traditionally done. Ended up raising $100 million, beat the government's response for COVID, looking at SNAP beneficiaries, and distributed $100 million 18 days ahead of the US government doing anything. Fortunately, all of those donors then gave again to our international programs, and we went from a $40 million organization to a $250 million organization pretty much overnight. And today we're operating in 11 countries. We put a $250 million budget together. We are working on humanitarian crises, we have not yet figured out our Ukraine response yet, but actively crafting one with all the partners in the field there. Probably going to happen in the next day or two. Unfortunately, the new other world news has been kind of crushed. There was a huge cyclone in Malawi, where we do operate. It's got a couple thousand people dead and tens of thousands of people displaced, working on a response for that. If you'll recall, a couple months ago, there was a volcano in Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo. In general, our day-to-day operations are working to lift people out of poverty, right? So these are frequently rural villages, refugee camps, kind of urban poor in places like Kinshasa, finding them, giving them enough money, creating choice for them. A big part of our programmatic design is no strings attached, unconditionality. We strongly believe that the people who know what they need most are the people themselves. And so we give them cash as ethically as we can, give them the freedom to make whatever choices they want to make. We found frequently they make good choices to end up out of poverty, after they're done with us, and then move on. Frequently bad things happen in those neighborhoods. And so in conjunction with that, we try to take care of, you know, people affected by fire, flood, famine, war, displaced or otherwise, to prevent them from slipping into structural poverty over time. It's a pretty fun job. And as a finance guy, you get to do creative and new things every single day, which is great.
Talk to me about that. How long have you been with the organization now?
So I joined last May. So I think I'm right about 10 months. It feels like 14 years.
Part of the context is with all the what you shared so far about the journey from start to where the organization is now, it's really unbelievable for me to be interviewing someone at an organization that is doing change and scale in a huge way. And there's every level of organizations are needed, right? So I don't say it, you know, to disparage or, you know, minimize the impact that any other organizations are doing, but how you all have been able to scale and the dollars that you're moving, and especially in such a short period of time, is unbelievable. So I'm curious, like, I know, you know, we talked a little about, you come from, you know, the business world, the for-profit world. What were some of the things that the organization needed to do, even when you're talking about going from like 40 to 250 million, how did that go about? You know, what were some of the smart strategic things? Maybe were there some mistakes that happened along the way? Sure. And like, sort of like, what advice do you give to an organization that is going to be scaling rapidly?
Absolutely. A great question. And I've been working in tech-enabled startups for a decade, and a decade at McKinsey & Company before that in their tech-enabled services organization. I will say this is the fastest moving and most innovative organization I've ever been a part of. It feels a lot more like a Silicon Valley startup than most Silicon Valley startups that I've been a part of. And it's really the same question every organization faces, right? Like, what happens if you're successful? Your model was adopted, donors have trusted us. So when I joined last May, I'd say we credibly had about, we could probably move right about what we were moving, about $200 million is what we could move ethically. I would say in the 10 month sense, I could say with certainty today, I could move $2 billion tomorrow. If I had it, I could get the money out the door to recipients in 6 months if I had it. Big part of that is technology, systems, and processes. So our traditional model was literally sending human beings, you know, door to door in villages, doing manual registration. We have wonderful training. We have wonderful systems and processes built on the Salesforce platform to facilitate that, some nice big data stuff behind that to do sanction screening and like fraud detection and all kinds of interesting things there. However, when your interface is person to person, that only scales so quickly. So really what it comes down to is, how do I get a human being to reach a lot of human beings effectively? Been working for the last couple of years with the help of Google.org and others on what we call mobile aid, which are ways to completely remote, touchless delivery of cash in a way that does sanction screening and identity verification. The Togo program that we did was the first manifestation of that. The Togo government wanted to do a COVID response. We went out and used satellite imaging to kind of identify the poorest of the poor within their rural communities and use mobile technology, telecom and mobile money to deliver cash to people without ever having met them, using call centers to do a lot of our follow-up in an interesting way. That went really well. We won an innovation award at South by Southwest. And then slightly, I won't say cooler, I think it's kind of cooler. The Democratic Republic of Congo, one of the hardest places on the planet to do a thing like that. 26 million people in Kinshasa, 60% of whom live below the poverty line that we just described. They wanted to do a COVID response. It's their money, their program, their people. And they gave us lists of people, and we were able to deliver cash to 50,000 people in about a week. And the fastest payment we had in that transaction was 40 seconds. We literally drove a truck through the neighborhood, text Give Directly. If their phone number matched the government list, they had a short form they had to fill out. Cash was in their bank account as soon as they hit submit, if all the information checked out. If it didn't, a call center person would call them afterwards. So kind of, and you know, we are working in low-tech environments. There are no smartphones. It's feature phones everywhere, light telecom networks, no bandwidth. And so that creative problem solving, how do we best leverage the resources we have to do that? GiveDirectly is incredibly blessed in that we have phenomenal people. And so it's like the kind of the best thing I could recommend to anybody is get great people. I'll give them the freedom to come up with creative solutions to impossible problems. Step back and let's see what happens. Our innovation team, you met MK, who's now the head of that, is in charge of thinking about cryptocurrency, satellite imaging, AI, ML, and ways to use those tools in places like rural Rwanda, where there's not even cell phone coverage, and successfully doing so. Failures. So our biggest misses, so I'll be candid and it's all out there, right? So it's with the Togo project, I'd say we got a little ahead of ourselves and started talking about our innovations, GiveDirectly's innovations, GiveDirectly's impact. And the truth is we don't do any of this alone. We do this in partnership with others, and we did not give the Togo government appropriate credit for the amazing census and survey data and the quality of the data and the targeting information they gave us. They got mad with us because we didn't properly credit our partners and kicked us out of the country for a minute. And we had to talk our way back and repair those relationships. And so, you know, understand your stakeholders, engage with them openly. Don't get a little too arrogant about what you do. You know, I would say that's lesson number one.
How does something like, I don't want to interrupt your flow here, but sure. You know, that's an interesting model or an interesting thought. I know now you're talking about dealing with, you know, governments and whatnot, but one of the biggest challenges that I see on a sort of a day-to-day basis with the organizations we work with, and most of these are, you know, domestic based, you know, or nonprofits doing work in the based in the US and doing work in the US, is the tension between their funding sources, right? And so that's kind of interesting. It seems to me, you know, if I'm understanding, like you're in there and you're, you know, bringing dollars and getting money in the hands of their citizens that desperately need it, and then that there would be that tension. So, I mean, do you?
I mean, so fundamentally I would, so it is sometimes hard to do good in the world, right? Yeah. And I'd say ultimately our appropriate role as an organization is to be the pipes between donors and recipients, right? All we are doing are connecting two sets of stakeholders, right? What we do is really, and as frictionlessly as possible. And so kind of making the pipes more important than the recipients or more important than the donor is rarely a good idea. And I would say, and I'll state this carefully, right? There are lots of international organizations who operate in lots of places with lots of programs for a variety of motivations. Mm-hmm. Most of them are great. Some of them are not, and few of them come with no strings attached, right? And so we come in as another NGO offering give cash to citizenry. And if one is thinking about this part of the world, and international organizations, both commercial and public, coming in to do various things, rarely has the well-being of the government or the people been a huge priority for these organizations. And so I'll say some of the skepticism that governments, communities, recipients have about us coming in is well-founded by those that came before us. I think it's absolutely fair. And a lot of the reason poverty exists in the places that we operate are from historical decisions that were not necessarily made locally, like colonial impact, you know, corporate exploitation, things like this, you know, like Democratic Republic of Congo is the richest country on earth if you look at the natural resources. People in the Democratic Republic of Congo don't benefit from that too much. And lots of people are responsible for that particular situation, right? And so we're, as far as they know, just another one of these people coming in for our own agenda to
create. Got it.
Right. And so we need to develop trust. We are very careful in how we do that. We need to be more careful than we are. And ultimately, right, our recipients, which is our primary focus and our primary value, recipients first, are citizens of these countries. This is their government. These are, in most cases, their chosen representatives. And treating them with dignity and respect is the same as treating their governments with dignity and respect. We wish the world were a more loving and trusting place and it were easy to go in and just say, hey, we're the good guys. We're here to give you cash. We understand that we need to earn that reputation by acting like good guys and acting as thoughtful partners with all of the stakeholders that we work with, including our commercial partners and telecom and modal money and banking partners, recipients, community leaders, formal and informal government systems. You know, we are the outsiders coming into your community as guests and should act accordingly.
Yeah. You've talked about giving money to, you know, getting the cash to individuals mm-hmm. into their bank account. But what about for people that aren't banked? I mean, how does the technology actually work?
Or what it's a bit of our special sauce. And so, yeah, the massive.
You know, not the trade secrets, but just, yeah.
We are owned by the public. I'm happy to share the special sauce with everybody. Okay. The massive majority of our recipients, people living below $1.90 a day, are unbanked and unbankable in most of the places that we operate. Really interesting innovation from mobile money networks. So Safaricom, in particular, MTN, others. Have these ways without a formal banking relationship to take digital transfer of local currency and cash them out at literal kiosks. The same place you buy time for your SIM card on your phone, you can trade mobile money using a feature phone. And so we are heavily connected with what we call mobile money vendors. And we have, you know, these huge accounts at Chase and Crown Agents and Standard Chartered and other banking partners. And we fund mobile wallets for Safaricom, MTN. Those get distributed down to the SIM cards of our recipients. The next question is obviously, well, many of them, don't have cell phones. We generally, as part of a program, give them a cell phone, teach them how to use it, give them a SIM and set them up a mobile money account so that we don't have to carry suitcases full of cash around. It's a lot easier for us to do that. We have carried suitcases full of cash around and we just prefer to do it. It's easier to give people a cell phone than deal with the security issues associated with that.
Yeah. And how about moving on from that? We talked, you know, leading up to this interview one-on-one about cryptocurrency and sort of the future of things. What are you guys doing in that space or where you think you might go?
Sure. MK, the guy you met, our innovation lead, this is his world. And the crypto community has been incredibly generous to us as a source of donation from, you know, from lots of folks that you've heard of. But we had 25% of our budget last year from the crypto community. Elon Musk is public, Glutarin is public. There are some ones that are less public. We have been the recipient of $10, $11 million worth of NFT proceeds over the last 12 months. And so the next logical question, you know, that community is heavily interested in kind of adoption of the technology and increasing its breadth. So for us, the challenge is, our dream is to be those frictionless pipes between donor and recipient, right? So crypto gets you all the way to that last mile. I can get crypto into a digital wallet for somebody on a feature phone today. But the problem to date has been, how do they turn it into cash and buy a cow or pay their school fees for their kid? Literally in the past 6 months, kiosks, similar to the mobile money ones, Bitcoin ATMs, things like this have appeared in some places that we operate, in particular Kenya. We were looking closely at the El Salvador experiment to do our first end-to-end crypto experiment. Donors could give in crypto, we convert it to some kind of stable coin, send it directly into the wallets, you know, for villagers in El Salvador. I'll say the El Salvador experiment from the outside looks a little unstable at the moment. And so we kind of wave that one off as our first one. The World Food Program did a really cool similar program in Kenya that we're going to follow behind on and test the waters to see if the recipients themselves benefit from that. And if the donor community is interested in it, MK, the thing he's literally in the next room doing on the whiteboard, is figuring out how to set up the conversion elements on a smart contract to kind of get the money in a multitude of currencies, convert it to something stable, get it into a recipient wallet in Kenya. The recipient goes to a kiosk, turns it into Kenyan shillings, goes to the local market, does whatever they want to with it. I'm personally pretty excited about that. Similarly, I'm in a couple discussions right now about launching new coins, both stable and otherwise, where we're embedded as part of the reward token structure and or beneficiary in the smart contract. So every time a token trades hand or there's a price confirmation or anything happens, you know, fractions of a token or a coin come our way as, you know, effectively the administrator of the coin. We're super excited about that. I'm particularly interested in thinking about, you know, a few years down the road, you know, targets in 2030, the mass majority of people living in poverty are going to be in places like Afghanistan and Yemen, hyperinflationary conflict zones. You know, I'm going to imagine, you know, cash economy in Ukraine here is going to break in a minute, where sending local currency is going to erode in value in 24 hours. The idea of being able to use stablecoin as a stable currency in hyperinflationary environments like Afghanistan, Yemen, things like that would be a really cool way to have real purchasing impact in a place where cash itself is falling apart. So we're exploring all of those things. And if we need help, I don't think we can afford any good blockchain engineers at the moment, but if anybody's excited about any of those, we'd love to talk to you.
Absolutely. No, I actually have someone I want to put you in touch with related to all the crypto. The other aspect, and I'm just curious, like the role that sort of you played in this and how it maybe has benefited. Shifting gears here. On your website, you have an area called How to Understand GiveDirectly's Finances. I've never seen a organization do a more detailed and transparent showcase, not only of their finances, but also putting it in context, you know, relative to other organizations. And so to me, this has just tremendous power in terms of your reputation, to partners or governments, you know, we talked about, and then obviously to funders that, you know, really can believe in what you're doing. I could only imagine actually how awesome it would be if every organization out there did something like this. So can you talk a little bit of what sparked? I know that it's sort of been the DNA of GiveDirectly, but it seems like this was more recently sort of overhauled and put together. Can you talk a little bit about that and
sure,
what your advice to organizations would be?
Sure.
Other CFOs running a $100,000 or $1 million or a $10 million nonprofit.
Yeah, and I'll say that even beyond nonprofit, transparency and trust are super important. I'm a 501c3. I exist for the public benefit. I am owned by the public. Having worked for investors, investors have a right to examine my books. But ultimately, like we make the claim, 90 cents of every dollar you give us goes into the hand of a recipient unconditionally, right? And we've done, as you say, an amazing job historically at kind of providing transparency into that. About 6 months ago, in the context of and by the way, thank you for your feedback on the website and what we've done thus far. I'm hoping that is chapter one of what's going to be a pretty exciting story this year. About 6 months ago, in the context of the UN, kind of putting a call out to Elon Musk, for $6 billion to help with a food program, there was a bit of a conversation about transparency and kind of proving that if I gave you $6 billion, it's not going to be run off in middlemen or spent on things other than things. And Elon Musk coined the term open source accounting. That sparked it. Like, that's a very good idea. Andrew Yang happened to like throw our name into the mix as somebody who does transparency well. But I started asking, like, are we as transparent as we could be? And ultimately, is there any reason that I wouldn't give effectively audit rights to all of my stakeholders? We're all my donors, all my recipients, all the governments we operate on, and let them examine my books the same way that I would an investor. And that kind of started a conversation internally. I was very excited about my job between May and September. When it took 24 hours for the entire executive team to say, yes, we want to put all our audit working papers out publicly. We want to create a system where anybody can explore our transaction data and not only know, you know, that 10% that doesn't go to recipients, how much of it goes to Jason's salary? How much do we pay in rent in our office in Nairobi? Who are our vendors? Like, who's getting the money that's not going to recipients? And so we're actively working on, with some AWS partners, creating a data lake to create a data exploration tool where anybody can go and look at how we spend our money, where the recipients go, how the you know, salaries of the exec team and our staff, what vendors we choose to do certain things. And should you happen to be a particular donor, we're shooting towards a world in which you can track your specific dollars all the way through our system to specific recipients on the other end. So we told you your money is going to Rwanda. Here are the 230 people that got your money. Here are the stories of what they did with the money. By the way, we lost 1% of it to fraud because we didn't run that. 1% is pretty good. But we didn't run that program perfectly, and kind of give you the ability to make an educated choice on whether to give us, again, whether to trust us with your money. I know a lot of nonprofits, with varying degrees of credibility, kind of provide that donor recipient connection. Our research suggests that most people perceive that as a gimmick. We're going to try really hard to do that in a non-gimmicky way, using a variety of technologies, Salesforce ecosystem, AWS, and in theory. So I am part of one of our pilot programs that does that. And kind of every month, I get an email telling me that money has left my bank account to go to a specific recipient. When that recipient responds to a survey saying, thank you very much, or I bought a cow, or I put a new roof on my house, that comes in unedited to me whenever I want it. And I think that's pretty cool. It's encouraged me to give again, and we hope it encourages others to do that again and to make those other conversations about trust and transparency easier. And then we hope, we have the thesis that not all organizations are as religious about getting as much of the money in the hands of the people to benefit from it as we are. And we hope that transparency lets donors make better choices about their partners and or just make everybody do their jobs better, which is great. I am quite literally a Boy Scout, and I love the idea. This is the first time as a finance professional, open your books to the public is one of the scariest things that you could ever say. And everybody was here like, yes, absolutely do it. And that's a pretty cool organization to be a part of. And the fun thing is no one's ever done it before. So I get to do it for the first time, which is very cool for me.
Yeah. I can see that. Yeah. How is your, do you think that this could be the last chapter in your career?
Ooh, that's a very good question. I am having a blast. That said, for the past decade and a half, I've kind of done the private equity 3 to 5 year Mary Poppins thing. Part of me taking this job, I have a VP of finance, Dennis, who sits in Nairobi, been with the organization for 6 years. Do I think a gray-haired white guy is the right guy to lead finance for an African aid organization? Not really. And so part of me taking this job is grooming Dennis in particular, should he want to take my job in 2 to 3 years. And he's very excited for that opportunity, and we're having a blast working together. And I think he's more than capable of doing that. That said, GiveDirectly is doing really cool stuff. And I, like to find a role for myself, whether it's this one or another. And I would, if things go according to plan, this will be a multi-billion dollar organization by the time we get to that point. And who says we don't have Eastern Hemisphere, Western Hemisphere, CFO as we start to branch out into other places. And Dennis does Africa and I do other things. Who knows? Life is long. I hope my last chapter doesn't come anytime soon. But the bar will be high for working on problems that are more exciting to me with people that I respect more.
Well said. Well said. I want to ask you just a couple of just very tactical things. I'm curious. So, I mean, sure. I run a organization, I run Charity Charge that I bootstrapped, and we've got five full-time employees and a handful of contractors. And that's been great. And, you know, I've learned sort of the growing pains. You just kind of jump in and you start to figure it out and stuff. So when you're running, like you have employees around the globe, how do you, for example, do payroll? Like we use Gusto to cut that. Like, are you able to use one platform? Have you been able to leverage systems so like those things kind of run on time and are just simple once you put them in place? You mentioned you all use Salesforce. We use Salesforce. That has been like amazing. So like, what are some other like little tools or things you kind of could not live without as a CFO?
Yeah. We're fortunate in that most of our organization is scaled to the point where we have separate legal entities in the places where we've lost employees.
Got it.
So our US entity, GD Inc., houses our New York employees. We went remote only as an option about a year ago. And so now our New York employees are scattered all over the globe. They took advantage of that remote policy. And so we've got ones and twos and mm-hmm. Berlin and Lisbon. Another thing, we too use Gusto, fantastic organization, great partnership. Remote is also great for one-offs here and there. In our local context, so we incorporated in Kenya, Rwanda, Malawi, and other places and have payroll vendors there that we deal with. Salesforce is phenomenal for keeping all the data state. We use Bamboo HR as our HR management system, which is fantastic. For aggregating across multiple legal jurisdictions. TriNet is our partner for US entity employees. They are pretty good. They interface with Gusto rather well. So our experience of managing payroll through them is mm-hmm. integrated and good. Slack is a godsend as a way to communicate across time zones and maintain a record of conversation. I would say we do an okay job in having someone manage how communication happens on Slack. I think is a necessary component. Just giving people Slack frequently leads to just another communication channel. If the right things happen in public and the right things happen in private, it can be a huge organizational enabler that we use well. We move ridiculous quantities of cash. And so having great banking partners to figure that all out has been, Standard Chartered and Chase in particular have been fantastic with us. Other tools that we think are generally amazing.
Let me ask you about a tool like as in the board as a tool. How involved is your board?
Super. So two of the founders are on our board. So Michael and Paul are there. Jacqueline Fuller, who's at Google, is on our board. Ali Jetty, McKinsey guy, is on our board. I'd say everybody is super active. Everybody is super passionate. I'd say Michael and Paul are part of the day-to-day operations and particular donor relationships, all very strategic thinkers when it comes to helping the executive team manage. So, I'll put a different hat on. I will say we have the best board that I have ever worked with in my career. I have not heard that be the norm in nonprofits in particular. Frequently, your greatest advocate or your greatest fundraiser gets a board seat as a thank you. I would strongly recommend people not to do that and to have people who can actually help strategically on your board. And then, there's always in the for-profit world, competing interests between the investors and the management team, both of whom are often, on a factionalized board in that world. And then my advice to executive teams would be, accept the fact that the only thing the board can do is fire you, take their advice within the context of what you think the right thing to do is, do the right thing. And if they fire you for doing the right thing, let them fire you for doing the right thing. And that would be my fourth.
You learned that one the hard way?
So I am at a point in my life where trying to make everybody happy is not one of my dreams in life. My goal is to make myself happy. I'm happy when I feel like I'm doing the right thing. I have frequently chosen the other way under a variety of influences, both the management team and the board, and have not ended up a happy man. I've made money, but I've not ended up a happy man in the process. And so, do what you think is right. Listen to the board and make your own decision. Right.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Thanks. Thanks for sharing that. Mike, Jason, how can people, what are ways that people can get involved? So I'm on givedirectly.org. I know there's microwaves, you know, even the header of your website, you know, lit, and you can click it up, but lift one person above poverty line by donating $30 a month.
Yep.
What are ways people can get involved, can help? I know you talked a little about like kind of getting the word out about getting experienced people in crypto involved.
Yeah. So I think we have 39 open positions in the United States right now, probably another 150 throughout the rest of the world. If you're looking to have a career that does good, please look at careers at givedirectly.org. We got a lot of cool stuff, particularly in the technology space. I'm personally looking for a data architect at the moment. If anybody's listening and interested in working with me on those transparency projects, please, your money is incredibly valuable. $1,500 gives people, about 2 years worth of choices to live above the poverty line. The program you just described is what we call Carousel. So we have people out in the field in Kenya. Their picture is up on the website. When you click donate now, that person specifically is going to get your money. That's the program I'm a part of, where I get the emails every month telling me what happened with my money. It's fantastic. There's a crypto donation page on the giving page. You can give us some 17 currencies. I think we have addresses there. If you have something creative, like a private equity portfolio or a coin that's not listed there, or if you want to do something crazy and exotic with us, write it info@jason.waters with two T's at givedirectly.org, and we'll gladly help find a way for you to help. And get educated about what's happening in the world and what real poverty looks like, and kind of, for the first time in human history, it is theoretically possible to have no one on earth living below $1.90 a day. We're going to take a big stab at that. It's 710 million people, which works out to about $7 trillion, which is actually a solvable problem with the wealth that exists in the world today. So get involved, right?
That's awesome. Thank you so much for your time, Jason, and being on the Charity Charge Show. Really appreciate this one. For everyone listening, this was Jason Waters, the CFO of Give Directly. Thank you so much for being a guest, Jason.
Stephen, my pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Take care.